Sunset FM 104.4.
Part 2. Mertzbau Hanover is a sculptural work, and it's indicative of Schwitter's artistic development up until the middle of the 1930s, when he finished this particular stylistic period that is now reconstructed. Schwitter's finished with the Dadaist period in about 1930, and this reconstruction demonstrates a constructivist style which Schwitter was moving towards. If you compare this to his sculptures in the 1930s, you can see the same aesthetics there. White plaster, very smooth surfaces, with only some small coloured parts. So the style of this reconstruction is very typical of Schwitter's work in the 1930s. He'd finish with this Dadaist thing. He'd finish with this chaotic thing. And this blurring of art and life. It was gone. It was his stylistic development. There were very private things in the Mertzbau, and he didn't want to show too many private things, so he closed off his grottos and he covered the private things with this plaster surface. Once he'd done this, he reached the point where he finally decided to make Mertzbau public. To do this, to make Mertzbau public, he published the three photographs we know and from which the reconstruction is built.
Hello, I'm Callie Spooner.
And when a photograph...
Oh no, hang on. Hello, I'm Callie Spooner, and I'm here with the artist Jesse Ash, and then later with Richard Wentworth via an interview, and also with a contribution from Will Daniels in a programme that we've been calling The Movable Column, and we're on part two. Kurt Schwitters is generally acknowledged as the 20th century's greatest master of collage, but for 13 years, 1923 to 36, he also worked on an extraordinary construction that came to be known as the Mertzbau. The Mertzbau in Hanover was a fantastically constructed interior, bewildering and abstract, and the walls and the ceiling were covered with three-dimensional shapes, and the room itself was crowded with materials, bus tickets, wrapping paper, newspapers and artworks in which what could be described as a 3D collage. This eventually spread to eight rooms of his house in Hanover, then eventually to a hut in Norway and a barn in England. Schwitter's Mertzbau was, on principle, an uncompleted work, but the Hanover permutation was destroyed in Allied bombings, then much later reconstructed by the Swiss theatre designer Peter Beisiger and the curator, Harold Zeman, from three black and white photos in 1981. This programme, The Movable Column, which is now on part two, has been gathering together a number of artists, curators and writers engaged in questions of reconstruction, finitude and work in progress to think about this story. And last week we were joined by Ben Kane, who showed us a work with no end. Isn't that right? A sound work with no end. And this week we have an interview with Richard Wentworth, which I'm going to play a little bit of now.
Things for you. Finish the object. And when a photograph of an object of yours, whether it's an object that you found within the street and transformed into an object through the photograph, or an object that you've made is published and circulated in magazines and publications and so on, is the kind of the ability for your photographs to be circulated and published important to you, or is it relevant to your work? What's your position on that inevitable circulation?
Well, I think there's a funny thing about artistic activity, which is that artists are processing the world in some way, and then artists become transmitters. But I always think that what I've done is it's got this sort of feeling of accidentally on purpose. I'm not sure I really intended that to happen. It's something that's arisen. So that's a bit like the way we have false familiarities with actors. Mm-hmm. So there are people with voices who have penetrated our interior, and they might be people who are regularly used as voiceovers in the media or even in advertising, it doesn't matter. And so we have a kind of intimacy with people who we've never met. And I think it's a quite unusual human space. You know, once the world started to get mediated, there's a lot of it. And I think my work is a little bit a cousin of that.
Does the photograph in some way finish things for you? Finish the object that you found in the street, or signify even a moment of finishing, finally finishing a sculptural work that you might have actively made rather than, say, passively found?
Well, I think there are two things. One is that I knew quite a lot about Schwitters when I was a student, inverted commas, because one did. And I think I always understood very well that whatever his collage activity was definitely not in the French department of collage and was somehow different. There was a different kind of acquisitiveness. There's a way in which there's something sort of archival or slightly sort of hoovering about Schwitters, slightly fetishistic. He's constantly pulling up this material from his world. And I have to say, I think of him as being quite literary. The word litter is connected to the word for bed in French, lit. Litter is the thing you have, it's a word about the ground, the litter. It's stuff that falls to the ground. It's a place where you might lie down to sleep, but it's also the place to which the rubbish of the world falls. And all of that's sort of tied up with how I feel about Schwitters. The broad history of the last 100 years, let's say, of how artworks get mediated has a sort of liturgy attached to it, where there are things that happen and then other things happen because those things have happened. Mm-hmm. So things enter the public bloodstream in some particular way. They usually enter them by photography and the printed image. And there's it'd be very interesting to test. There is a fantastic amount of art which is in people's mentality, which nobody has ever seen the original artwork. So that they, in a way, we're in this world of iteration. It's what Warhol understood very well. I think there's nothing so odd as the moment when an artwork is made ready for photography. It's, you know, there's a bit of the sort of exquisite corpse about it. You know, it's kind of, it's an embalming moment. It's slightly sexual. It's kind of dressed and ready for the act. And then the camera goes pop. And then the image is approved or not approved. Yeah. And it's incredibly elaborate. I mean, I think artists are incredible liars about what actually happens. I mean, there are a few artists who are very alert to those processes, and it's that the way they're alert is contained in their work. Somebody like Richard Hamilton understands all of this incredibly well, but I think a lot of people are very slightly faking it. There is something very, very odd about preparing an artwork, especially if somebody's making a lot of noise about the sanctity of the studio, preparing something ready for the photographic act. Also, there's a failure on the part of many artists to even really engage with what all the processes of art direction are, you know, how things end up on magazine pages, what kind of magazine is it, who's going to read it, where is it going to go, what's the quality of print, etc. You know, and a catalogue is only a smart word for a magazine.
Well, in the case of Merzbau, of course, acknowledging the sort of the readiness of one particular corner of Merzbau resulted in these sort of three photographs and that coming to represent the room, and also representing a shift really from a very private activity to the public. When do you feel like you know when an artist is ready to make the shift from private to public?
Well, I think that's long list of variables. I mean, I think there are people who talk about that in a very fetishistic way. There are people who have no interest in that at all. They work in perhaps quite a traditional studio way. There are lots of people working who Goya would recognise and understand, and then somebody else takes over at a certain point. You know, somebody arrives, takes the work away, somebody else photographs it. Some artists are extremely engaged in that process, others not. There's an awful lot of art production at the moment which is exactly that. It's product, and as the product comes off the moving belt of the art world, it plops into these processes that make it ready for the market or ready for the world. I've done all of it. I've got things ready for the market, you know, like cleaning the pig to take it to market. And I've had things where something's almost appeared like a mushroom in front of me as a happenstance. And I think these questions go into other questions about what does it mean to be professional, you know, because the Mertzbaum actually disappeared, mm-hmm. because we bombed it. You know, when we say Schwitter's got one bit ready and then pronounced that it was, as it were, ready to be born, we don't have precise enough access to that. That's a fable, and in the fable I hear the language of art historians. I'm not sure that artists are that well organised, and I know that I know very well for myself that you can be in a sequence of events where something has to be made. There's a deadline. Somebody says, you know, some French magazine says, this is the size of the page, we need it for tomorrow morning, and if you could get it at this quality, we would be very pleased. Please put it in the post with a, you know, with the best postage stamp on. Possibly we need it very quickly. And you do it because you're being professional. And I think there are things which I think I've let out too early. I think there are things that I've held back. But I'm not that interested to... I'm not that fetishistic. You know, I think you have a body of work, and the body of work contains some language, and it's then in the world to be judged.
Okay, so Jesse hasn't heard that interview because I literally did it about half an hour ago.
Mm-hmm.
But I think there's some nice things in there. I mean, for me, the most interesting thing about that is the idea of the deadline, I suppose, and being forced to draw something that every day, whatever we're working on, we're always forced to draw something to a close. And we've obviously spent some time being sort of obsessed with the possibility of Mertzbaum not finishing. But before we have a conversation, I just wanted to say that that was Richard Wentworth, who is a British sculptor, who primarily, sort of throughout the 80s, was involved in the construction of sculptural works, but also began the kind of collecting an archive of photographs of objects and idiosyncrasies that he'd find in the street, and he called this archive Making Do and Getting By. So there's a sort of a double relationship to photography within Richard's work, which on one hand has to do with him using photography to turn certain objects that are found in the streets into sculptures, if you like, or into objects, and then also the kind of the relationship that Mertzbaum and Schwitter's encountered, which was the moment where your sculptural works are photographed for press or for print or for circulation. And that's what the interview is about, really.
Mm. Yeah, no, I love the way you said out and out artists are liars, which, you know, is fair enough, to be honest. But also... I think you could say that galleries are liars as well. If we're talking about how work is sort of made available through photography and through image, and I think one of the things I've been thinking about over the last few years is, especially as you're getting more and more galleries that are in, I don't know, maybe not main hubs of, you know, like New York, London, and wherever, Berlin, but you're getting galleries that are arriving from smaller places, and the reliance on the sort of invitation to a show that never gets seen.
And the website and all the kind of the peripheral material, which becomes a sort of a stand-in for...
It's absolutely crucial. It becomes a sort of a primary contextual framework to not only begin to see the work, as you might do if you were going to actually witness it, but it starts to become the whole thing, you know. And if you think about PDFs being sent, or, you know, artist portfolios now, you know, zip files with quick downloadable PDFs, and speed at which curators are looking at stuff, and, you know, if you can think about it now, there's thousands of them being looked at on laptops on trains from Geneva to, you know, wherever. And is this sort of if you think about that as the process of what's, you know, the amount of movement of people between art fairs, let's just take Europe, forget America for the time being, just in Europe, think about the people that are moving and what they've seen and what they're talking about specific, and we can come back to this later, but what they're talking about, they're talking about objects they've seen, they're talking about shows they've seen, or perhaps witnessed or heard from someone else. But so much is based on this sort of supporting material, which of course main part of that is the image, but maybe there's less actual time spent with the work.
I don't really go and see shows anymore. I mean, I don't see that much artwork anymore, which is absurd because it's the, you know, I suppose it's the industry that I'm involved in, and you'd think that within that you'd sort of build in your time to make it a regular occurrence to visit original artworks in, you know, the original exhibitions that have been sort of designed and constructed to support these things. But it becomes easier to just, you know, experience these things through really mediated sort of modes. And I think it's interesting when we think about sort of Schwitter's understanding, even sort of, was it 1932, 1933, when he made the decision to not necessarily allow people into the Merzbau, but to photograph a part of the Merzbau and to circulate that photograph, and not just to anyone, in a sort of a really high-end French cultural magazine, and then send those photographs to MoMA, to Alfred Barr at MoMA. There was already there this really implicit understanding that perhaps the best way for him to communicate this thing wasn't for people to necessarily experience it as it was, but was through these, you know, well-lit, slightly fetishized, well-dressed, you know, photographs. So it's been going on.
Yeah, except for, I mean, in a way, to those, I mean, I'm not sure that they should ever been. I mean, he was up for them being recreated, but he decided it was that those photographs actually marked the finitude of that those rooms. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, I'm thinking of how Brancusi was thinking about photographs of his studio, or, you know, there might have been argument to say that maybe they should have just existed as photographs and the whole thing should never have been
reconstructed at all from those photographs. Yeah, I mean, it's a weird thing to do, isn't it, to rebuild something. I mean, because we're talking about a sort of a double destruction here, aren't we, in a way? We're talking about the initial act of destruction of the principle of Merzbau as being a ongoing, mutable, evolving work, with the staging and the taking of those three photographs, and then the double destruction of that, which was the reconstruction, you know, the fixing in time of Merzbau through this 3D remake of those photographs, so it's sort of three times removed now or whatever.
Which seems weird. when you're talking about the fact that he went straight to Alfred Barr, you're thinking, okay, so he's making a decision from, as we just said, about from private production to public exhibition. Or revelation, or whatever you want to say, or, you know, access, public access. And what he's doing by doing that is forgetting a local audience, a localized audience, a German audience.
Hanover.
Yeah, right, exactly. That was never, at that point, was never part of his philosophy or idea, or that wasn't part of his audience. because of the political situation at that time as well, which is important. But what then became the audience was this networked art world, journals, bar, MoMA, which is exactly what we're talking about, which is going on now.
But then I think it's, I mean, let's think about what the alternative is, what Schritter's alternative was. He's reached the point where he's been working and labouring on this construction for 13 years. He's got a feeling it's pretty special. He's sort of moved through three different artistic kind of periods, Dadaist period, literary period, and he's finally reached this kind of constructivist, you know, period in one particular room, and he feels like there's some kind of cultural value within this, and he wants people to know what's going on. There's two alternatives. I mean, he can either photograph it or he can open it up to the public. And I think we were sort of loosely talking about this the other day. I mean, what would happen if MoMA had some kind of Hanover off-site project where, you know, you could set up some situation, some frame, if you like, around the Merzbau in Hanover, where people could sort of go and visit this studio in progress. Because the thing we've got to remember is that Merzbau was also Schritter's studio. And so there's another weird element of this, which is that he's actually sort of cordoning off a corner of his studio and declaring that an object and photographing that and deciding that he's not going to work in that anymore, he's not going to add to that, it's not going to be a sort of a creative thinking space like perhaps the remaining eight rooms in the house that he was still working on were. And I'm just trying to wonder what it would be like if Alfred Barr had created a sort of a Hanover offsite for MoMA, where people, rather than seeing the photographs at MoMA, where you could actually go and visit Schritter's in his Merzbau in Hanover. And I think it would be sort of hideous.
Are you talking about this where institutions are starting to sort of reveal parts of their process of looking after art as well, wasn't it?
You mentioned that, went to a gallery where you could actually see the conservators, the people that were doing the conservation work on certain paintings, working behind glass. Mm. So you could see the act of them sort of peeling off layers of decaying paint and applying fresh new paint.
I can't remember the name of the it's the really beautiful institution just outside Basel in the countryside. I'm sure I can't remember the name of it.
Bayeller.
Yeah, the Bayeller. Right. Thank you very much. And and they were having this González Torres show, mm-hmm. which was curated, I thought, brilliantly alongside their permanent collection. Mm-hmm. So you had Torres poster works next to Mondrian paintings and stuff like that. Anyway, so you go through the show, you know, great show, and then amazing landscape, but that's sort of by the by. But this, I'm just talking about the process of how you go through an exhibition, and then you go down the stairs sort of on your way out, and people familiar with the institution will know that at the bottom is like these big glass doors where the conservators are working, and like Kelly says, they're sort of, you know, peeling away and putting up and remaking or preserving or da da da. And if you think about the idea of Schwitters, who was sort of doing the same, I mean, in reverse, if you see what I mean. So he's putting on these layers of images and stuff like that and juxtaposing da 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 da, and then he's covering it. And it's sort of like, I don't know, this the past and then the future at the same time.
I don't know why that's interesting. In the same way that I don't fully understand why, I mean, often you get, I think it's very easy to also sort of fetishize research and process and a lot of different things that artists just necessarily have to go through in private. And I think there's been a bit of a move towards it being quite exciting perhaps to expose those ordinarily private activities and bring them into the public. I'm not sure. What are we doing next?
We're going to listen a little bit more to the interview we had in Hanover, played and acted out by Dulcie, I think.
Cool.
These three pictures of the Merzbau appeared in a French magazine in 1932. And in 1936, he sent a selection of Merzbau photos to Alfred Barr at MoMA. They were exhibited in 1936, so that was the first time he published or presented Merzbau as an artwork, as a finished artwork. Very often it's written that Mertzbau Hanover was unfinished, and that the Mertz principle was to make a never-ending flow of process. This is more or less true for the Mertzbau and Hanover, although we don't know anything about the other rooms. We only know that they existed, as Schwitters himself mentioned in his text published in 1931, in the Mertz publication, Volume 31. But in the room that is now reconstructed, he was finished. He had finished. And you can find this to be true through his letters.
So, we every week we... Well, no, it's not every week. God.
It's when we've got enough material.
Yeah, when we turn
when we've
up.
Collected enough things to add to.
Yeah, whenever we do these things, these programs, we're sort of in the process of asking artists, particular artists that might have a relevant practice of some sort, to select a cover, a song which has been covered, something. It's obviously a copy of something that's already existed. Also, just makes it a bit more fun, really.
Less boring. Last week, Matthew Copeland gave us a cover of a Duran song. And this week, we've got a song called Love Hangover, which is a cover of a Diana Ross song by The Associates. And it is from Will Daniels, who you're going to tell us about.
Well, Will... Will is a painter, really. Well, he's a painter, and he makes beautiful hyper-realist oil paintings. At work a few years back, where he used to make sculptural maquettes, I suppose, out of cardboard and things like that, based on famous historical paintings, Caravaggio's, Monet, and various stuff like that. And then he'd make amazing reproductions, realist paintings of quite small. I don't know, maybe I'm looking at here. 40.
Size of a shoebox for people that can't see Jesse's hands.
This is why it's so good working with you, Kelly.
I'm like the radio mum.
Yeah. I suppose. Anyway, they're small paintings, and basically I asked Will to think about a song, not only because he makes work which is about sort of not only collapsing dimensions, as because he uses photography of the object, he paints from the photograph of an object which is then of a painting, so he's going through all these different processes which sort of collide with some of the things we're talking about, but also because when I had a studio with him, he always used to he paints like a proper artist, gets in early.
9 till 5.
He doesn't piss about. He's like a real artist. And but he used to have massive headphones, like the ones we're wearing now.
Yeah.
I was always he'd always be listening to music, and I never quite know what it was. But I think it might have been.
It might have been this. Should we play it?
Mm-hmm.
really quick question. Do you have any destroyed sculptural works or destroyed works of art by you? And would you ever reconstruct them or allow them to be reconstructed by someone else?
The question of the original work of art is endlessly interesting. And I think it's a very painful discussion that work ages exactly as we do. So things deteriorate, fall to pieces, there's a huge industry. It's called conservation, which is people re-entering the space in which work was produced mm-hmm. and trying to resolve it, trying to stop the world. I've destroyed lots of work, and I've destroyed it mostly for economic reasons. I've destroyed it because I can't afford, or I can't be bothered, to maintain all the organisational structures around looking after it. And as the time passes, you know, 20 years, 25 years, 30 years, 40 years, a sort of feeling of disconnection can set in. There are all the other variables. You know, I've lost work in the MoMA fire. There's flood, moth, rust, everything corrupts. So I think there's a sort of point, and maybe this is, affects different artists in different ways. Maybe it's also attached to different kinds of success, what we mean by that. But I think you have to get very realistic that you're not likely to keep, especially if you make eccentrically shaped things that aren't easy to store, that you may end up just having to get rid of stuff. You can represent these fables in ways that make them sound rather noble or righteous, and I find that rather offensive. There is a way of saying, you know, apparently, you know, she took all her early work into the garden and burned it under. You know, it's a piece of story making. Mm. But we do that with all sorts of other things. You know, we suddenly realise that we've got a lot of sweaters with moth. And we get realistic about it. We're annoyed with the moth, but it's true.
So if somebody saw a picture of one of your sculptures that you had destroyed and loved it so much and wanted it in a show so much, as Harold Zeman did when he asked for the Schwitters Merzbau to be recreated in a show on reconstruction, actually, would you reconstruct a work for someone? Or would you get someone else to reconstruct it?
I think it's always circumstantial, but I would reconstruct things. I think what's very painful, it isn't possible to go back into the moment of invention. And if you're an artist like me who rather ridiculously wants everything to feel like they've invented it for the first time, I'm not. But while you're working, there are those few moments that artists get, you know, some get more, where you go, yes, I've invented this. This is a special moment, and it's late at night and you think, look how this works, and you get very excited and engaged. Clearly, copying that moment, i.e., you know, if it's a simple physical object or relatively simple physical object that can be reinvented, it is always going to be a reinvention, and that's obviously part of what's so strange about reproduction furniture and trying to live the Georgian lie. And even trying to have, you know, the lifestyle of 1950s rural Britain, you know, it's all got.
And would you let anybody else reconstruct it for you without you there, just by looking at how it looked the last time it was made?
I would be very interested to be in that relationship with another person. And I have children who are capable of that, and I would be very interested to relate to them across that space. I don't think it would be very happy, but I think it would be a very interesting thing to visit. But I think that's like lots of other kinds of pretense, or there are lots of other things. This is all part of the psychology of why we talk about cloning the way we do. I don't think many people have got a very elaborate sense of, don't think many people are that confident about what it means to be a surrogate. So when somebody says, will you, as happens sometimes socially, someone says, will you stand in for somebody? The very request is odd. Are you to be somebody else? Well, asking an artwork to do that is also odd. I think there's something here which is like why we think echoes are interesting. Because what is it? It's the third, fourth, fifth iteration of something. So there is something about that. There's something about the experience of artwork which has got an idea of veracity in it. And I'm not being righteous. I'm not talking about, you know, the original object. I'm not meaning to put on the tone of the art, of the wise art historian. But I think there is something about feeling. There's definitely something to do with, I want to say authenticity, it's not a good enough word, but we do that with each other. We go, I think he's faking it, or I don't think he can have meant that, or she's not serious, or, you know, so, and obviously we're complex, and in the way we read each other, we then value somebody else as being them, but being sufficiently like us that we can relate to them. And that capability or that capacity that we have with each other, can be not even a close relationship. There's something about that mutual space, the respect that's in it, the human space, it's a moral space, is very like what happens in any art experience.
Okay, so... that was Richard Wentworth again, talking about artworks that he's destroyed or would or wouldn't reconstruct. And the thing that I sort of liked most about what he was talking about initially was the idea that if he were to reconstruct one of his artworks while he was still present, as opposed to in the case of Schwitters, where I believe it was reconstructed in his absence, which was why he couldn't, well, of course it wasn't, why he couldn't help with the reconstruction. Richard was talking about this idea of perhaps his sort of children sort of stepping up in a way and coming on board to help him reconstruct, say, one of his destroyed artworks. And I was just thinking about the role that Ernst Schwitters, who was Kurt's son, played in the reconstruction of the Merzbau, who, while he was working with Peter Beisiger, who was the Swiss theatre designer who rebuilt Merzbau technically, he was also obviously aided by Ernst Schwitters and the memory that he had of the Merzbau. And I just really like this idea of sort of handing something over, sort of through the generations, or you know, the memory of something or the understanding of something, and how much trust and intimacy needs to be in place in order for it to be possible for it to be okay for a reconstruction to take place. And I don't know, I mean, I guess that's why it was so important that Ernst Schwitters was involved in reconstructing Peter Beisiger's attempt at rebuilding the Merzbau. But I really like that idea of intimacy and trust, and this idea of it only being okay if you hand it over to somebody that understands your intentions or knows you incredibly well. Because otherwise, what would you get? Just a sort of a copy, a really useless copy from a photograph or from something that you remember. There needs to be something else underneath the translation, I suppose.
It is interesting. Richard mentioned his children, isn't it? I mean, if we talked about Kurt Schwitters, if we went, rather than down a generation, if we went up a generation, we thought about his relationship to his dad. I don't think that would have been something because he basically used his all the money he was left, wasn't he? His yeah. dad didn't approve of what he was doing, and it wasn't that relationship, you know, probably not conducive to that sort of trust, and therefore similar things. And then so Richard's pointing out, okay, I'm feeling it with my kids.
Mm-hmm. They can do the job.
But then not everyone's going to have, I mean, Bacon's studio, that was reconstructed. He's got no children. So who was involved with that? And how?
Yeah, who's the emotional responsibility almost?
And do you have to have that? I mean, from a curatorial point of view, like you're trying to recreate something which is like quite cheesily and romantically the soul of the artist's production or something like that, and we can't do that simply externally or institutionally. We have to have someone that has a genetic or some sort of intense personal relationship with that artist.
But equally, Richard was saying the artists themselves couldn't achieve that sort of recreation of the kind of the soul and the energy that went into the original thing. I mean, he was saying, yeah, absolutely, he would create, he would reconstruct one of his works, but it would be a slightly empty experience. It wouldn't be like the first time, that magic first time where, you know, something came together and there was this moment of kind of creativity and a coming together of things. And I suppose for me, when we visited the reconstruction, the Merzbau reconstruction at the De Sprengel Museum in Hanover, the thing that struck me the most was just how soulless the thing was. I mean, it was soulless. That's really the best way of putting it, I think. It was like an abandoned stage set or a weird prop.
It felt a bit like an annex to the institution as well. I mean, that was the thing, that it was just like a little, it's like you'd slipped down the back alley and you'd gone into the storage cupboard or something like that. You know, it was very much.
It looks a bit like a store cupboard, didn't it?
It
looked like someone had left all their constructivist props there.
Yeah, no, it was a small thing. But I was thinking as well, we were talking about reconstruction, but we were talking earlier as well about not necessarily reconstructing, but maybe repeating or caring for. You know, I remember talking with you, and you were talking about the word from curating. You know, it's to care for, and it, you know, Richard was talking about standing in for somebody and the possibilities of doing that. And we're thinking of Will Holder's going to be doing something
next time,
and I mean, he's a prime example of someone.
Will Holder is a designer, so he spends. Will Holder is an artist, but his artistic practice, it could be said that it is publication and design, which involves the stepping up of others or enabling others to step up, and in a way finding different ways to speak through other people, with other people, and not about what they do or who they are. I think that is. And, you know, it is interesting in relation to the conundrum that the Schritter's archive curator in Hanover has, which is, how are we supposed to represent Merzbau? How are we supposed to speak through this thing, speak of this thing, show this thing without speaking about it? And for me, the reconstruction is very much about, I mean, it's like a like-for-like representation of the thing, and in doing so fails to embody so much for me, you know, for me. And I think it's sort of interesting that perhaps sometimes very carefully speaking about something isn't necessarily the right way of bringing it back into existence or allowing it to exist.
But it's, I suppose, before we, you know, moving on to something else, but it does open a question when we this idea of repeating or saying scripts or quoting people or being a vessel for someone else, caring for something, in relation to the thing about how that or there is a potential how you construct access to a certain audience to allow visibility for these processes. And we were talking before about that at the moment there's this sort of, I don't know if you want to use the word trend, but a definite interest in exposing process, exposing
research,
the construction of things
in contemporary art production at the moment.
Particularly
in London, in particular.
Yeah, I mean, things you're involved in things recently, but also the talk show as well, and at the ICA and stuff like that. What's that about?
Well, talk show at ICA, I mean, there were certain artists that were showing in that exhibition. So talk show was a curated show at the ICA in which a number of artists, a couple of artists, were using the ICA, I suppose, as a studio or a workshop space or somewhere where they could almost map out their research and show that kind of to the public, which was fascinating and a really nice thing to do. It's quite interesting that there is a leaning towards allowing that to happen at the moment, or towards wanting to see that, and that perhaps it's not enough just to see a finished object or a finished art object.
But this is the thing, I mean, we're talking about the revelation, the visibility of an ongoing process, or the recognition of an ongoing process, which never actually, no one ever witnessed the true ongoing process of Switters Merzbau. Except for himself and his son, or his, the select few people that went there, but there were very, very few, and so there was no encounter with the ongoing process.
So it may as well, it didn't exist. I mean, it doesn't exist. That ongoing process that we're here talking about and thinking about, really, it doesn't exist. Merzbauer's three photos,
and the construction,
and the construction,
the very, you know,
but that's not what Schwitters made. I mean, that's like saying, you know, Richard Wentworth's sculpture doesn't exist because he destroyed it. And I mean, obviously it doesn't exist because he destroyed it, but it never existed. You know, it was never there because it's now exists as a photograph, and that is what it is. It's saying it's now a photograph.
But he was willing to for the work to be reproduced. Like when you asked Richard if he would be. Schwitters was very much affirming the idea of these getting remade from the photographs, wasn't he? So he was authoring the potential for them to be remade.
Do you think he was? Do you think from those photos he would have ever anticipated that Harold Seesman would come along, you know, in the 80s and do a show on reconstruction in Bern or wherever it was, and say, you know, yeah, let's rebuild it. Like, let's have the Merzbau in the show. I mean, I don't know. Would he have done that? I mean, it's impossible to say.
Well, he was up for. The idea was that they could be reconstructed
by him, by him, not by other people, and that it wasn't that he would create. Because Schwitters made other Merzbaus elsewhere. He made one in Norway and one in the UK, and his ideal was that the Merzbau would spread from Hanover to Berlin and then from Berlin to wherever, and that it would just grow and grow and grow. But yeah, absolutely, there could have been other Merzbaus made, but they would not have been the same. They would not have tried to emulate precisely the Merzbau in Hanover. They would have taken on the same principles, intentions, activities and approaches in the original, and created something new that was appropriate to the here and now of his current working practice at that particular point in time. This reconstruction is very different to Schwitters starting something again.
I want to read something in a minute, but I want to finish this little point that we're talking about, because we'll forget about it next time we do it. But the thing about this visibility of process. I was doing something recently in Stuttgart with Beatrice Gibson, similar ideas of opening up processes of production. The ICA thing, talk show, the premise of that, similar. You've been involved in similar projects. Why is it happening now? Why is it now? You mentioned about something to do with objects, and what do you think? I hate to put you on the spot, but I am interested.
I don't know. I mean, my feeling is that it might have something to do with, because the thing about sort of research, you know, exposing artists' research or exposing artists' working processes is that it's pretty much product free. You know, it doesn't generate any objects. And that's why a lot of conversations have been framed as artworks, or a lot of gatherings have been put in galleries.
a lot of things that would ordinarily be considered processes of study, private activities and so on have been brought into the public and framed by certain, and they're immaterial, those things are kind of immaterial. And I was just thinking, which doesn't answer the question in any way, just how much work in general in the UK is immaterial at the moment, how much communication labour has to take place, if you like, how little industry we have, I suppose, here in the UK now, and how much work for many people is to do with calling people up, having a negotiation about perhaps a stock or a share or a bond or something that doesn't even necessarily really exist, trading, banking, you know,
this
all
is what
these
I talked about gold the other time, and you didn't understand what I was talking about.
No, but I actually...
permanence of gold.
The permanence of gold as a moment of fixity in an otherwise
instability
in an otherwise immaterial process of flux and non-tangibles. And I listened back to it, and I understood what you meant, and I'm sorry I belittled you on that.
No, that's fine. I understand.
But I'm really interested in, and I know we're running out of time, but I truly believe that that there is a correlate between, and this sounds so pretentious,
go on,
the state of the economy,
yes,
the state of society,
yes,
and the way people are using process and research with no product as a form of art production. We need more gold. We need more Richard Wentworth objects.
I think so. On that note, I'm going to read something which isn't an object. It's actually people pretending to be books. Oh. So this is Ray Bradbury. It's Fahrenheit 451, which was made into a film. I can't remember the date or anything, so but this is for those of you that don't know, I'm gonna have to be quite quick, but basically there's it's a sort of it's a bit like when the Nazis were burning the books, and there's a sort of fictional society where firefighters are going around trying to find any literature, burning it, and the guy Montag, who was a firefighter, one of the guys who was burning all the books, has now realised that this is a problem. He's run away from the city, and he's going out towards the countryside to escape this helicopter that's running after him. And so he's just been welcomed, and by this group of nomads in the forest, but he sort of is not quite sure if he should be with them. So he says, "I don't belong with you," said Montag at last, slowly. "I've been an idiot all the way. We're used to that. We all made the right kind of mistakes, or we wouldn't be here. When we were separate individuals, all we had was rage. I struck a fireman when he came to burn my library years ago. I've been running ever since. You want to join us, Montag?" "Yeah? What have you got to offer?" "Nothing. I thought I had part of the Book of Ecclesiastes and maybe a little of Revelation, but I haven't even that now." "The Book of Ecclesiastes would be fine. Where was it?" "Here, Montag," he said as he touched his head. "Ah," Granger smiled and nodded. "What's wrong? Isn't that all right?" said Montag. "Better than all right. That's perfect." Granger turned to the Reverend. "Do we have a Book of Ecclesiastes?" "One, a man named Harris in Youngstown." "Montag," Granger took Montag's shoulder firmly. "Walk carefully. Guard your health. If anything should happen to Harris, you are the Book of Ecclesiastes. See how important you've become in the last minute?" "But I've forgotten." "No, nothing's ever lost. We have ways to shake down your clinkers for you." "But I tried to remember." "Don't try. I'll come when we need it. All of us have photographic memories, but spend a lifetime learning how to block off the things that are really in there. Simmons here has worked on it for 20 years, and now we've got the method down to where we can recall anything that's been read once. Would you like someday, Montag, to read Plato's Republic?" "Of course. I am Plato's Republic." "Like to read Marcus Aurelius?" "Mr. Simmons is Marcus. How do you do? Said Mr. Simmons. Hello, Montague. I want you to meet Jonathan Swift, the author of the evil political book Gulliver's Travels. And this other fellow is Charles Darwin. And this one is Schopenhauer. And this one is Einstein. And this one here at my elbow is Mr. Albert Schweitzer, a very kind philosopher indeed. Here we all are, Montague. Mahatma Gandhi, Gautama Buddha, and Confucius, and Thomas Love Peacock, and Thomas Jefferson, and Mr. Lincoln, if you please. We are also Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. Everyone laughed quietly. It can't be, said Montague. It is, replied Granger, smiling. We're book burners, too. We read the books and burnt them, afraid they'd be found. Microfilming didn't pay off. We were always travelling. We didn't want to bury the film and come back later. Always the chance of discovery. Better to keep it in the old heads, where no one can see it or suspect it. We are all bits and pieces of history and literature and international law. Byron, Tom Paine, Machiavelli, or Christ. It's here, and the hour's late, and the war's begun. And we are out here, and the city is there, all wrapped up in its own coat of a thousand colours.
That was lovely. Okay. We're going to have to go now. But thank you very much for listening. This has been the Movable Column. And I've been here with Jesse. I'm Callie. This is Jesse. Thank you very, very much, Richard and Will Daniels, and also Dulcie Jocelyn for reading the part, the historically responsible part of the archive curator in Hanover. And also thank you to Cambridge School of Art for giving us money to do this. I've just got one more really short track to play, and then we're done.
Time, Schwitt has tried to encourage people from abroad, particularly from New York, to invite him to make a similar kind of abstract sculpture. And so, by the time these photos had been taken, this part of the Mertzbau was not a studio and not a living room anymore. And when Schwitt has described what Mertzbau was to Alfred Barr through letters that are now in the MoMA archive, he explicitly said, "This is not interior design, it is an artwork." It was a principle of Schwitt's work that all things belong to all other things. He aimed to make relations between all other things, and that was the Mertz concept. But for him, this room, that was photographed and is now reconstructed, was more or less finished. We know this because he let photographers in. He made professional photographs, and he offered to make a new version, like this Mertzbau at other places abroad. This is why we know about this one room, as opposed to the other rooms, which had also been Mertzed. These other rooms were in the cellar, under the roof. There were any rooms that were empty, or within which no one needed to live or work, or which were only for guests. Schwitters could use such rooms, but they were not as important as the first one, now reconstructed, which he started in 1927.